even my endocrinologist was like, well, I don't think it looks like PCOS hair loss. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but my hair is falling out and I can't have that. And as someone who's also had like body dysmorphia and issues with that, like my hair has always been my protection in a lot of ways. When I had it really long, I kind of used it to cover my body when I wasn't feeling very secure about myself. So like for all the things like this to be going was horrible for me. So I went back on, and that was also kind of when, that was the first time that I was like, maybe my stress is doing something also, because, you know, I didn't feel necessarily more stressed, but clearly my body was reacting in this major way.
The start of the new year gives us an incredible opportunity to reflect on all that we want for 2024. If your goal is to finally start seeing some improvements in your PCOS that you can actually maintain until this time next year, then our OV app is perfect for you. We identify what's driving your PCOS symptoms and set you up with the right treatment plan, which includes about 5 small but really powerful changes to what you're eating and how you're living. And as you'll hear from these stories, those small changes actually work. But as well as this, we also give you some drug suggestions that you can talk with your doctor about if that's the route that you want to take. We give you all the information that you need to see improvements in your symptoms, whatever your New Year's goals. So head to ovie.io, the link's in the show notes, and start the questionnaire to find out what's driving your PCOS. Today on the podcast, I'm interviewing the lovely Mariah. As you'll likely tell by her incredible storytelling, Mariah works in Hollywood and so has had a tumultuous year with the writer's strike action. But instead of letting this throw her for a spin, she used this time to really focus on making lifestyle changes. Mariah's had a history of binge eating disorder, and it was through listening to other women on this podcast that she realized that binge eating and PCOS were so connected, and in actual fact affects maybe up to 40% of people with PCOS. So making lifestyle changes can be really triggering if you've suffered from disordered eating. But as you'll hear from Mariah, the right changes can actually support binge eating recovery. And by not overtly focusing on weight loss, but instead focusing on what she could control, her stress management, sleep, joyful movement, and small tweaks to what she was eating, Mariah still has seen changes in her body shape and weight, but without the associated triggers. I'll let her tell you the rest.
So Mariah, thank you so much for joining me today to tell us about your PCOS story. We're so grateful. And I am also so keen to hear a bit more about where your PCOS story began for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I got an IUD when I was 21 years old, and I had had regular periods. Like, I hadn't really struggled with acne or anything before. I had been on birth control, but I was just kind of tired of taking a pill. So I decided to get an IUD. I had it for about 4 years until I turned 25. And in those years, some things started to change slowly enough that I didn't really notice at first. I was having problems with acne for the first time in my life. My hirsutism, you know, started, and I was growing hair along my neck that, you know, I told my mom about, and I was like, I think it's hirsutism. And she's like, stop reading things on the internet. That's not the way you have. And, you know, I went to a dermatologist and they sent me to an endocrinologist because those are very common, you know, hormone symptoms. And they diagnosed me at 25 with PCOS. I got the IUD removed because it wasn't helping. And I went back on the pill. And then they put me on spironolactone for my acne and hirsutism. And they didn't tell me anything about insulin resistance. They didn't tell me anything about, they didn't even mention that there might be trouble getting pregnant at some point. Like, it was really just like, go back on the pill, get your spironolactone, and, you know, you'll be okay. We'll check in every 6 months. And I was like, okay. And then I didn't really do anything about it for another year and a half because it was just like a thing that I knew I had, but I didn't really know what it meant. And yeah, I didn't know. And then I saw a TikTok about PCOS belly and like that kind of extra weight, you know, that some people hold in their stomach, which was, you know, the case for me. And I was kind of like, whoa, maybe there's something here, and maybe there's like a community out there. And so I went searching and I stumbled across this podcast, and it, you know, changed my life. So here I am.
And what was the episode that specifically you listened to or that changed things for you?
Yeah, I'm very lucky in that it was episode two in the list, and it was about a woman who had binge eating disorder, and which was very much the case for me growing up. And I listened to it on the way to work in my car, and I was crying in my car because I'd never felt so seen before in my life. And I just hearing like the statistics of how many women with PCOS have binge eating disorder and the correlations there of this thing that had always made me feel so alone. And at that point, I had gone through eating disorder specific therapy and felt, you know, very much in recovery, which is also something that the woman was talking about on the podcast, and just kind of, you know, being in the right place for, you know, making these kinds of changes. And, you know, so it's not particularly triggering for you, but it's also something I mentioned when I first started the protocol to you guys so that you would be aware, and you know, it never really was a problem. So that also was a pleasant surprise. But yeah, the second episode, as I mentioned, you know, the Spotify wrap just came out, and I'm in the 0.5% top percent of listeners of this podcast. So clearly I've stayed.
You've clocked them all.
Yeah.
What was it that Amanda was talking about that you were like, wow, I feel seen in terms of like the binge eating side?
Well, again, first of all, just the numbers were really shocking to me, and that this was how common it was, because it's not, you know, I had some friends who had, you know, different disordered eating patterns, but binge eating disorder is also very specific, and like it's the one that like you can't stop and you don't feel in control. And like the other ones are kind of about more about control, like you they I it not comparing, you know, eating disorders in any way, but like it was just one that felt under talked about. I knew what it was because I went through a specific, you know, program, and but it, like it wasn't something that like I knew other people really had. And so just hearing that part of it was crazy for me. But like her relationship with food, her relationship with her body, like, you know, and those how the binge eating, you know, the what's the word I'm looking for? The episodes, and you know, and everything like that. And it was lit, like word for word, it was my life, you know, for a good couple years. So that was just really, it hit me in a lot of different ways. And even outside of like the PCOS, you know, stuff, because I didn't, it was episode two. So I also didn't really understand anything about, you know, PCOS at that point and the correlations between them. So, but just like, I felt like this was the right place for me after that.
And I think that's a really important thing about disordered eating is to, because so much of, I mean, although you had been gone through therapy and were in recovery, so this wasn't so much of an issue for you, but so much about disordered eating is the secrecy, right? And it's like actually opening that door up to the secrecy of the binges and the shame and guilt that comes along often alongside those. And then what I found really interesting when we were doing our disordered eating practitioner training was just the seeing how much that is related to blood sugar, like low blood sugar, and being like, wow, like yes, this is often thought about as a psychological condition, but so much of it is also physiological in terms of driven by like when you're restricting. I remember one of the case studies we did of patients where she was having like she was have you know binging and then feeling so much guilt and shame that the next day she would be like, right, I'm not going to eat anything, or I'm just going to eat a tiny amount. And it would be like a green leaf salad and a Diet Coke for lunch. She'd have no breakfast, green leaf salad, Diet Coke for lunch. By like afternoon, her blood sugar had dropped so much that then she was being driven to go and seek out all of those sugary, high carby, high like fat foods to bring her blood sugar back up. And then that was contributing to the uncontrollable nature of it, because it isn't. When your blood sugar is that low, your body's like, you have to go and bring this up. Like, you don't have control over this. And so that to me was so interesting and going, wow, we really need to attack binge eating disorder and PCOS from both sides. We really need to, you know, really get in control, understand what it is that's driving that, driving I mean, really, it's about the with when it becomes like a disorder, right? There's the psychological part that's really driving that disorder, but also the physical part of this, like low blood sugar and stress and all the other drivers that contribute to then be able to help someone really get fully in remission and feel a lot more in control around their eating.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of something that was like the core of the therapy that I was doing. It was very much like log what you're eating, not calories, not, you know, anything like that, but what you are eating to make sure you're eating enough throughout the day to kind of have that. Obviously PCOS wasn't involved, so it was for me like a bagel for breakfast or a breakfast sandwich or, you know, things that I wouldn't do now, but it did really, you know, at the time it was the step that I needed, and it did really help stop the binging. Because if you're, it's when you have the long restricting period and then you're like shaking and itching to grab anything around you and then you just can't stop. So just making sure that you're eating enough, and then obviously coming into the protocol with that in the back of my mind, and then, okay, now what should I be eating and what should I be looking for? And like, you know, prioritizing within that, you know, really helped me. And I was very pleasantly surprised that I was not ever really triggered by, you know, any of the parts of the protocol in regards to my binge eating disorder, which was a fear of mine when I first, you know, dietitian is a scary word, and like, you know, because not everybody's on the same page with some of that stuff. So just hearing that binge eating episode was like, oh, like they get it. And so maybe this could really work for me. And it did.
Yeah. And I just think that it's, that is such an important part though, is that first step of going, we actually just need to get that regularity back into eating. And it can be anything, right? And it's just sort of that making that first step and then doing what you did, which is like, okay, so I've made that first step, now how do I just tweak that to make it slightly better? And and I think that's such a the perfect way of approaching it, because it just it needs to happen. But then also taking away that guilt and shame and hearing your story and other, you know, other people's story to then say, wow, okay, this is not just me. Because I think when you're in that, when you're in it and you are feeling especially that guilt and shame around it, you do just feel like, wow, why can everyone else kind of control what they're eating, or they, and I can't, like, what is it about me that makes me different? They, you know, well, I mean, the stats of binge eating disorder and PCOS are, they vary greatly, like hugely. The research says could be up to 60%. I think they settle on 3 times more likely if you have PCOS to have like binge eating disorder. And then you realize, wow, like that's a huge number of people. I am so far from alone here.
Yeah. And like any stats, just the fact that, and binge eating specifically, like that disorder, just the fact that there was any correlation blew my mind, you know, and everything kind of came together at that point. And, you know, and then it turned out that this, you know, dealing with my stress hormones ended up being harder for me than the eating after all of that. So
So tell us about that, because your underlying drivers for PCOS are definitely the insulin, right? We've talked about that a little bit, about how that, but the other one was stress. And so how did that show up for you?
I'm a high functioning stressaholic, I guess. So I think I'm just constantly so stressed that it's, you know, it never really felt like anything different. 2 years ago, I decided to go off of the spironolactone because I just didn't want to be on it anymore. I was feeling better, and everything came back full force with a vengeance. And, you know, the biggest thing that came out of that was hair loss that I'm still, you know, working on now. And it's partially because for some reason, when I went off the spironolactone, my stress levels went through the roof. So beyond my, you know, acne came back, hirsutism came back, and then my hair started falling out. And, you know, the dermatologist didn't know what was going on. And even my endocrinologist was like, well, I don't think it looks like PCOS hair loss. And I was like, I don't know what that means, but my hair is falling out and I can't have that. And as someone who's also had like body dysmorphia and issues with that, like my hair has always been my protection in a lot of ways. When I had it really long, I kind of used it to cover my body when I wasn't feeling very secure about myself. So like for all the things, like this to be going was horrible for me. So I went back on, and that was also kind of when, that was the first time that I was like, maybe my stress is doing something also, because, you know, I didn't feel necessarily more stressed, but clearly my body was reacting in this major way. And then I started the protocol in June of this year, 2023. And that happened to be during, I work in Hollywood, and there happened to be 2 strikes going on between the writers and the actors. So my job got suddenly very, very quiet and much less stressful. And I think the lack of stress was actually where I noticed a difference. Now everything is full force again. And so I'm kind of trying to bring back some of that, you know, the good stuff that I had going on before. But it was easier to find time for me. It was easier to find time for exercise. And it was actually the perfect time to start this because I really got to prioritize it. And now it's fitting it into my real life and what that looks like. But it was really for the first time of like not being very stressed that I was like, oh, this is what breathing feels like. So now we're back to being a high functioning stressaholic, but you know, I have all of the tools and information that I got from you guys. The thing is that like meditation has always felt a little hokey to me, and like just that kind of, you know, I don't know. I'm very self-aware, but that like self-reflection in those ways was just never something I really thought about. So there was one thing that was like, write down everything that stresses you out. And I couldn't. Like that was more daunting than like change anything about your eating. Like writing down what I was stressed about, I physically couldn't do it. And, you know, I told you that, and that was like what stopped me. And you guys recommended that I try journaling. And even if I do it for 5 minutes and I feel silly, like, you know, just try it and see how it goes before bed. Cause I'm very much the tired but wired situation. I'm in the dark for hours. My mind's racing and I can't fall asleep even when I'm desperately tired. And so I found this old prompt journal that had like three entries in it from 2017 that I had given up on it. And I was like, well, I'll use this. I'm not going to go, you know, buy anything. And within a week, I had journaled every night and, you know, way past 5 minutes and just filling out all the prompts and answers and everything. And it really, really helped my sleep. And I actually just finished that journal and had to go buy another one. So that's never happened before in my life.
Amazing. Why do you think that, so going back now that you're a bit more have that self-awareness from the journaling, why do you think that it was so challenging for you to write down what you were stressed about? Was it that you couldn't articulate it or that it was too scary to put on paper?
I think it's just, there were so many things like, and they felt like things that I couldn't change anyways. Like I have a very stressful job, but I love my job and I love working in the industry that I'm working in. And that's never going to not really be stressful. And the strike was stressful in its own way, but not in the day-to-day, like, you know, my schedule and everything. And so, you know, there was that. And then, okay, well, I guess I'm, you know, stressed maybe about friends or stressed about this. And it was like, none of it felt like I could do anything about them anyways. And so it felt like I was just going to be writing down every piece of my life to what end, you know, like, because I can't make these changes. But just the journaling process of writing down my feelings and not even my feelings. Like some of the prompts were like, you know, what made you smile today? And like, you know, what's one thing that you love about your body today? And like, you know, what was one way that you were active or, you know, whatever. And sometimes my answer was, I survived the day. And that's how I was active today. Like it was, you know. And kind of just finding that space to accept myself for whatever the day did look like was really helpful. And yeah, without actually having to like change the stressors at their root, more like, you know, what you've said before about like, this is something I get to do, not something I have to do, and like change your mindset around them, because there was nothing on whatever that list would have looked like that I would have been comfortable cutting out. And that stressed me out.
Yeah, exactly. So thinking, wow, there's nothing I can do about this, and this is going to be my life, rather than just going, actually, that's okay. We can still do hard things. It's not that mm-hmm. we have to stop doing everything and wrap ourselves in cotton wool, but it's that, how do I get this out of my mind so I can actually sleep, right? That's because things way worse. And that was interesting that you said about accepting the day for what it was. Because was it previously that you would get to the end of the day and you'd be stressed because you hadn't achieved everything? Or was that something that you were feeling and that was then making you more stressed?
Definitely. I also started writing to-do lists in my like journaling, which was also very helpful, because part of me staying up was, you know, and especially when it came to food or, you know, exercise or more lack thereof, you know, if there was a day that I was like, I do that nighttime thing where you're like, tomorrow is going to be different. You had this. And those are what the 2000 pages were like. Let me tell you, I did read them. They were not healthy. But I just that like, okay, this is what happened today, but you had a really hard day and you got through it and you did this. But writing the to-dos, because I would also always just like that was the one time that my brain finally stopped going at 100 miles an hour. And that's when it was like, okay, what do you have to do tomorrow? And, you know, so, and then it was staying up and also like trying to make sure I would remember that in the morning and, you know, writing things down. And I actually had a separate notebook that was just a blank notebook that is, I've never actually, I used, I think maybe one time, but for something you recommended of just like, if you have a thought in the middle of the night, even if you can't see the paper, write it down and like, then you can deal with it in the morning. I think I used it one time, but the knowledge that it was there really helped me because I knew that I could have that option to write something down if I did think of it later. And then a thing that I started doing in my journal kind of on my own and felt really silly at first and then got something probably my favorite part of it, I started writing affirmations, which is not something that I ever, again, like all of it felt kind of like, not silly, just like obvious. Like, yeah, I like that about me. And yeah, like that all makes sense. But just starting with a couple, and I actually started writing, I started with you are statements. So like, you are awesome, you are smart, you know, and kind of talking like I was talking to a friend. And then one day I just switched to I am statements. And that felt big to me, even though it was just kind of, it just felt like a natural progression. But like, I didn't feel comfortable writing I am statements at the beginning. It felt more comfortable like I was talking to another person. And then it got to the point where, no, like I am these things. And, you know, even in the second one, I find little spaces, even if it's in the margins, where I can, you know, write some affirmations and just make myself smile.
That's such a good way of doing it, because you're right that it can feel really, yeah, not silly, but just obvious, or I already think these things, so why should I need to put them down on paper? You know, that's, and that it can also be quite daunting to look at a blank sheet of paper, especially when it's the starting with I am, and you're like, oh, I'm not anything. But when you switch it around and be like, imagine you were talking to a friend, then that is such a much more gentler way into it, which isn't it ridiculous, right? Isn't it ridiculous that we do feel like that? But we do, right? And again, it's like, okay, well, meet me where I am right now and deal with it, rather than just going, this is silly that I feel like this, but okay, let's just own it and deal with it. And then realize that one day it will start to feel more normal to say, yeah, no, I actually am. And I'm confident in saying that now. Do you think that that's transferred into anything else in your life? Do you think that's come through in the way that you maybe approach things at work or your confidence by doing these affirmations and this journaling?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's some kind of staples that I always have in my affirmations. And then there are some that are kind of like based on what happened that day, or if like something's coming up the next day. You know, if I have to like give this presentation, it's like, I am a good speaker. Like, I am confident. I am, you know, strong or brave or, you know, whatever. Or if something happened that day, it's like, I am good with conflict resolution. I, you know, kind of like rewarding myself for behaviors that I was proud of. Or if something didn't go my way, kind of just like, sometimes I would just write, I am going to be okay, was an affirmation that is in there. Like, they're not always like, I am going to figure things out and things are okay. And a lot of times it was also like, I am prioritizing myself. I am prioritizing self-care and, you know, that kind of stuff, which was both a reward to myself and a reminder to keep doing it, you know, kind of for today and for the next day. This is something that you're prioritizing and, you know, be proud of that. But also, if it can't be every day, it can't be every day.
Yeah, that's, as you said, a really good way of like both a reward and a reminder to, especially in those times where you really need it. Like sometimes it just flows and it's just easy, and other times it feels like a real struggle. And so writing that down when you're having those times is such a great idea. I really love that. Anything else that you've gleaned from doing this exercise that you're like, wow, if I could go back to, you know, January 23 Mariah, and I could tell her, hey, you're going to get this year, what would that be?
Well, first I would tell her to buy an eye mask. First things first. That was something that I heard in the podcast before. So I bought one before I started the protocol itself. And that also, you know, changed everything. And there are nights where, you know, I'm sleeping somewhere else, you know, and it's a complete game changer. I also have I got the silicone ear plugs as well. I've only used them a couple times, mostly if I'm like in a hotel room with somebody else or like with someone who snores or something. And it's like, I am in my own space, my own world. But then there have also been some nights where I haven't been able to use them and or I've forgotten them or something, the eye mask and stuff. And I notice the difference in my sleep quality. And I can't, you know, I can't journal every single night either. There are some super late nights that it's actually more important that I get to sleep than spend the, you know, 15 minutes that I would in my journal. But I do also notice a difference kind of between the two of them. And I've also been doing a before bed book and reading like, you know, a 10 to 15 pages to a chapter before bed to try and like, you know, reduce screen time and stuff like that. And it's also been a, you know, I was reading like The Power of Habit and then I switched to a rom-com because I needed something easier on my brain to go to sleep and stuff. So my sleep patterns have definitely been one of the bigger changes. And yeah, I would just tell myself to start doing them all sooner.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how much you realize later how lack of sleep or poor quality sleep affects everything about what you do. We had a conference here last week and some of the lead researchers from Monash University in Melbourne who write the International Evidence-Based Guidelines for PCOS were over, and she was speaking about some next research that they're going to, potential research they're going to do. And one was on focusing on sleep instead of anything like dietary related, because she's a dietitian nutritionist, so that's her area. But she was like, what if we actually tackle sleep first? And then let's like nutrition and that come second. How much better do we get people feeling and able to actually engage in changing what they're eating when that happens? And I was like, yes, that is exactly what. And actually someone to recognize that and say, yeah, okay, like sleep is the big domino here. Like if we actually help you sleep better, then it's not going to be such a pull to get you away from that sugar, or you're not going to be craving it as much because actually your brain is driving you to do that at the moment because you just don't have enough sleep and it's surviving in that way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That was, and even having enough sleep, but waking up and still feeling exhausted, you know, even though I did get my 8 hours, and then kind of also thinking about, okay, well, what happened last night? And also, am I on my period? Because that messes everything up in my life. And I don't even have I'm on the pills, but so they're, you know, bleeds, I guess, more than periods, as I've learned. But yeah, that's still, every month is a game changer of like, what's going to be my problem this month? And sometimes it's my sleep is out of whack.
Yeah, that's so interesting, especially on the pill. Although it's so interesting, so a lot of the pills are what's called biphasic or triphasic. So it's not the same amount of the progesterone and ethinoestradiol that's in the pills every day. They mix that to kind of try and mimic what a natural cycle would look like. So it could be that you're on one of the biphasic or triphasic ones and therefore they are reducing that.
Yeah, I'm on loloestrin, and there's even like the two, there's different pills the 2 days before the sugar pills that are, I think, a slightly reduced dose to kind of like lead you into that. So it's been great for my symptoms, and overall I feel really good on it, and I have very, very light periods on it. But I definitely like the hormone and side, and like my back hurts, and like all of like the period symptoms, like kind of the week leading up is, you know, always a thing. So my sleep is definitely get affected by that. But, you know, doing what I can to mitigate and what I can control, I try to control.
And because you said that you were previously on the IUD, right? And that when you found out you had PCOS, you went off that because it wasn't helping. That's really interesting because a lot of people are on an IUD or get told to go on an IUD. So how did you know that that wasn't helping for you?
Well, I thought that the IUD was what was wrecking my body, like that I was having essentially a bad reaction to it. Not, you know, again, I'd had it in for 4 years at that point, but the first year was totally fine. Second year, probably fine. I think it was like year 3 and 4 that like things very slowly started to happen. So it was to the point where I'd look in the mirror and be like, I guess I have a lot of pimples right now. But like, I'd never really, like, especially outside of my period, like I'd never really had issues with acne. But it happened so, and like with the hair growth and stuff, like it happened so slowly that I just kind of accepted it as my new normal. So I actually was convinced for a very long time even after I was diagnosed with PCOS, that like my IUD like is what was causing these problems. But then, you know, they obviously didn't go away. I learned more about it, especially with insulin resistance. And I just think that it gave this, you know, and there were also, you know, I was in college at the time, and, you know, there's a lot of life changes in there. And I think that plus, like, you know, being on the IUD, which like doesn't give you the little sponges that, you know, the pill does and everything, were kind of just ended up being a bad combo for my body. So I got it a year before I needed to and went back on the pill. And that's definitely been the right move for me. But it was nice to not have to take a pill. So if the IUD works for you, you know, do it. Mm. And it was good for me for a couple of years. But yeah, so for a while I was convinced it was the IUD. And obviously now I know it was my PCOS.
What IUD did you have? Did you have the...
I had the Kylena.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's just slightly smaller than the Mirena.
Yeah. And I think that that's interesting to talk about, because a lot of people do get told to, you know, to go on the IUD. The thing with it is that there's no IUDs that are anti-testosterone, anti-androgen. And that's where it certainly wasn't helping your hirsutism and your acne, right? And a lot of people do get told to go on it because it can help, especially for endometriosis with pain. And so therefore, people are getting pain and PCOS, they often put two and two together and say, oh, well, this works with people with endometriosis, so why don't you go on this too? And it's like, completely different mechanism. No, like that.
Yeah.
It's not the case. And actually, let's actually look at this person and say, well, they're asking me to help with their hair growth and their acne, so let's put two and two together and say, well, actually, let's put you on an anti-testosterone one that's actually going to help that, or in combination with a spirone like you were, if that works for them. Although interesting for you that certainly was a trigger for the hair loss, which was super interesting.
Yeah, the coming off of it. And so I've been basically since July, like, slowly weaning off. And you know, and I'm currently at like 50 milligrams a day, and I'm probably going to stay on that for a while, because I am, you know, starting to just notice a little more acne here, and kind of, so, you know, making sure I'm adjusting my, what I can control in the process. And, you know, and you guys have mentioned like zinc and other, you know, I drink spearmint tea and, you know, some of the other more natural stuff, because I'm not at the point where I'm, you know, even really thinking about kids yet. But I also know that you can't be on spironolactone while you're trying to get pregnant or are pregnant. And I know what it's like to just go off of it cold turkey, and that definitely didn't work for me. So I'm kind of trying to figure that side out now before it becomes a real issue for me.
And that's what we always recommend, is talking to your doctor and weaning off it rather than just coming off cold turkey, because it is, as you said before, it's acting as a sponge for all that testosterone. So when we just take that away, it's like suddenly there's no sponges to mop it up, and it can cause havoc again. So, you know, like, we can work on trying to reduce it while you're on it, and then gradually wean off so that your body gets a chance to start producing its own sponges again, rather than relying on the spironolactone to do that. And the beauty of that is that you can't really wean off the pill. It's pretty much an all or nothing thing. It doesn't really
matter. You have to take it for half a cycle.
So that's the beauty of spiro, is that at least we can do that, and why it can be a really helpful drug for so many people, especially getting those symptoms under control. The other thing that I have loved about our chats on our group consult calls has been the way you found an exercise that you love, right? Like, you love your kickboxing. And I just think this is so amazing to talk about, because it can get a bit misconstrued. We often talk about, for people with high stress hormones, that some exercise actually might kind of be making that worse, and depending on what that is. And I think it has become really misconstrued in social media, especially TikTok and Instagram, where people that don't really understand the fundamentals of what they're talking about with that, or they're trying to make clickbaity reels to attract people with PCOS to what they're talking about, and saying like, these things are bad for PCOS. And that's just, it's way too black and white. We need to have a lot more like conversation about what you're doing, what your symptoms are, and therefore what's working for you. And that's what we've been able to have in our conversations, right? It's because I think initially you were like, oh, so I've got high stress hormones, so I can't do this form of exercise. And it's like, no, absolutely not. Like, we can make that work. We just need to understand what it is, how to modify it. So how did you make that, what would otherwise be classified as quite a high intensity exercise, that might have been exacerbating your stress hormones and therefore making it harder. Because the thing is it's not that it's making PCOS worse, and kind of in inverted commas, it's all about your underlying drivers and the fact that you weren't able to get to sleep at night, you're waking during the night, you're waking up feeling really tired. Like, if we then go on and add in way more stress hormones to that from lots and lots of high intensity exercise, then yeah, we're just overflowing that bucket. So what did you do to modify that and make it work for you, regardless of what your stress hormones are doing?
Yeah, definitely. I love kickboxing. I went this morning, and it's something I try and do kind of at least once a week. It's also, you know, work making it work with my schedule. They are like an hour and a half usually, so they're also kind of on the longer side. But within that, there's, you know, it's usually a pretty big class, and it's more about like fighting techniques and self-defense than like and one and two, like kind of a, you know, a dance class, for lack of a, you know, better. It's more like technique, and you know, you fight the instructor, and he, like, you know, they kind of teach you how to defend yourself within that, which was also something that I was really, really into. And you know, part of it is some days I, you know, your staple of, you know, 15 minutes afterwards, how do you feel? And you know, 9 times out of 10 I'm still very re-energized afterwards, but there are also days that I do my class and I'm like, I am wiped and I want to take a nap right now, like as soon as it's over. And part of it is, you know, did I push myself too hard? Did I have a bad sleep last night? Am I on my period? You know, again, all of these different things that can contribute to that. And yeah, so for me, it just brings me joy. And, you know, and it was something I think I checked with you guys like 3 or 4 times, like, it's okay that I'm doing this, right? And you're like, as long as you feel okay, it's okay. And so yeah, it's an exercise that I really, really love. But again, because it's not, with the strikes being over and stress being back and my schedule being messy again, it's, you know, I for sure go on every Sunday when I can, but going during the weeks has become a little harder as well. So I actually just purchased a walking pad that is all over my TikTok and probably a lot of other people's, that I keep in my room, and I can use it while I'm working from home. I have a TV in my room, so I can, you know, I live in a little apartment, but I have a TV in my room, so I can also just be walking and watching TV, which is what I really, really wanted. Especially as we're heading into kind of even in Los Angeles, it just gets cool and dark, you know, by the time I get home, it's pitch black outside, and I might be in self-defense classes, but I will not be walking outside alone at night. So, you know, kind of finding the ways to supplement, you know, my new schedule and everything like that with my, you know, the thing that I really love, but still trying to incorporate movement in other ways as well, and not be the one thing that I rely on, because then there's the added stress of like, oh, I couldn't go this week, or, you know, I was too tired from it, and, you know, those kind of things. So trying to stay in a place where it continues to be a good thing for me, but also making sure I'm getting in the overall movement that I need as well.
Yeah. And I think that's so important, is just being realistic, right? Just being realistic and go, well, I would love if I could make kickboxing 3 times a week. But reality is, at the moment with my schedule, and I can't. Like, I literally, these classes are on at these times. And like, if I realistically look back at the last 4 weeks, have I got off work at that time? No, I haven't. So I just am going to have to be. And realistically, I'm not going to go walking in the dark, because I do not feel safe doing that. So this is, yeah, a great. And how have you found it really good? Have you found that you've used the walking pad?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a brand new, like, I got a Black Friday deal. So I've only had it for about a week now, but it's been really, really nice to have. And I also noticed, you know, because I'm so exhausted after a long day at work and everything, I was coming home and I was, you know, watching TV and sitting on the couch, which felt really good for an hour. And then after an hour and a half, 2 hours, I was just like, I still want to keep watching, but I wish I could be moving right now. Like, I don't want to, like, I want to stay in my cozy home and I want to keep watching my, you know, the show I'm binging on, but I want to be moving while I'm doing it. Like, you know, and so I would, you know, do some stretching on the ground and stuff like that. But this just kind of was the perfect fit into my life, rather than turning my life around to try and fit a new form of exercise, or like convince myself that I'm going to get up every morning and go to a class and, you know, do the things that I know myself and I know my schedule and I you know, especially when I am trying to prioritize sleep, that's not always an option for me. So this is kind of going to be a really good at-home situation. Yeah. And it's something I saw on TikTok. They call it cozy cardio, and just kind of, you know, redefining your relationship with movement, and that it can be, you know, you're in your room, you're wearing your fuzzy socks and your tennis shoes, and you're drinking your favorite drink, and you're watching TV while you're moving. And kind of this, it doesn't have to be high intensity, and it doesn't even have to be like feel like exercise. Like, you're watching TV, you just happen to be moving at the same time. So that's been really fun for me. And then on top of that, I get my high intensity, and I get my, you know, my fulfillment out of my weekly kickboxing, but then again supplementing that in a way that still feels fulfilling to me.
Yeah. And I think that's it's such a good thing. They talk about it, about pairing habits. You know, when you're trying to create a new habit, pairing it with something that you already love doing is way more likely that you're going to do it. Okay, I'm loving watching this show. I can continue watching this show if I also walk on the walking pad, right? And giving yourself a bit of structure around that. Say, this is, yep, that's cool, but these are the rules. These are the bounds, you know, like the bounds that you have to. How do you find it? Have you tried it for work yet?
I have not tried it for work yet. I do have like a little balance board that I put, because I have a convertible standing desk at my home. I'm also, when I'm in office, which is 3 to 4 times a week, I don't have any of these things, but I do have a convertible standing desk there. But so there's also more opportunities there to just like get up and go to the other side of the office, or go to, you know, lunch isn't 2 feet away from me in my kitchen, you know, so I already get a little more movement that way. But when I am home, I have a little balance board that just kind of keeps my body engaged. I also have some lower back problems that I've had for a couple of years now, and just like pain places. So also, you know, sitting on the couch for too long isn't good for me, and ends up hurting me in the long run. So trying to, you know, find ways around that. So I haven't actually tried it well working. I would definitely have to go a lot slower. I did almost fall off one time while I was watching TV, but it's just, you know, something to, it's a new mechanism to get used to. But yeah, I think if I'm working, I would have to go a lot slower. But yeah, I haven't gotten the opportunity to try that yet, but I'm very much looking forward to it. I think it's going to be, again, just a good game changer. And if I do it for 30 minutes a day and that's it, like, I'd be thrilled. But there's also something you can be doing, especially if it's slow enough, like maybe you're just like going a mile an hour for an hour, you know, and just kind of moving the tiniest bit and just keeping your body warm, if nothing else.
Yeah, exactly. I would say from my experience, you just pick tasks that are relatively easy to do. So it might be where you're like having to read something or having to watch something, or that it's in, you know, in a meeting that you aren't necessarily the leader of, you're more of a listener and like maybe a small contributor or something like that, then it's really good for those kind of tasks. The more we're like, you're having to quite like really focus on writing, I found those ones much harder to.
Yeah, that's when I would trip for sure.
Yeah. And I don't even think it's more that you trip, but you find that you just, I don't know, like I just found like I needed the concentration of doing absolutely nothing else. You know, when your brain is like that exercise, when did they get you to do this at school? Maybe it's a New Zealand thing where they get you to rub your tummy and then pat your head. And you have to, like, after a while, you just start rubbing your head and patting it, you know, like you're it's so hard to do those two things, especially different sides of the brain together. So I don't know. I personally found that was just too, like, I just needed the focus of when I was writing something, I just needed it to be just that one task. But there was much other lighter tasks in your day that you can do. And I found them really easy to do while walking, but it does have to still be slower than what you would otherwise walk, which is fine. But I think too, a lot of people are like, oh, but what if you fall off? What if you fall off? It's like 10 centimeters above the ground. What can really go wrong? Like,
I know, and mine's right next to my bed. So it's kind of worst case scenario. I'm horizontal on my bed. I also got one that has a like bar that can be folded down, so it goes under my desk, or it can be, if I'm just have it, you know, out to watch the TV, I can have the little bar up so that I can, you know, have something to grip if my balance ever feels like an issue. So that was a positive for me, that to have both options. But yeah, it's like, you'll be okay. And they're small, and they only go so fast.
I mean, I think that there'll be a lot of people that are like, oh, yeah, you think what could go wrong. I've like torn my ACL or done this, but
oh, I'm sure.
The fact of the matter is you could do that same thing outside, right? Like trip mm-hmm. on a curb, like whatever. It's just that, you know, I think we've got to be a bit realistic. And it's not about like what you're doing. It's about that was just bad luck. And taking some risk and going, okay, like, yes, there's some small risk here, but hey, look, if we don't take any risk, we're never going to be living. So I think that's such a great idea. And I think it's such a good idea to be really realistic about exercise and any habit change you're trying to create, right? It's just going, let's not, and this is where especially coming into, you know, the new year. I mean, we're recording this in December, early December. I'm already thinking about, you know, January and what people will be thinking during that time. And a lot of it, there's so much pressure to take on these huge lifestyle changes where you do everything at once. And then you go hard and you might do them for 8 weeks. And then you go, actually, this suddenly has got too hard and I can't fit this into my life, or work suddenly ramped up again in the new year. And you know, if you've got kids, school's back, and you've got all of these other responsibilities that just don't fit with this intense kind of program or lifestyle change that you took on at the start of the year, and then you're back to square one. So being, I think, taking those small steps and being really realistic and making, as you said, making it fit in with realistically what my life is, rather than trying to change something that's actually probably not going to change. Like, as you said, you know, the demands of Hollywood are not going to change, right? And your ability to survive on less sleep is not going to change. So getting up earlier is not going to work. So it's just, well, this is what will work
for me. But within that, like, there's, which was another reason that I got the walking pad too, is like, there's getting up earlier to like go somewhere, to the gym, to a class, come back, shower, and like, those are not, you know, those minutes add up when you need to get to work at a certain time. And I have my commute, which is not great.
Well, you know, staying in LA, having the walking, be great.
Yeah, shocking. But having the walking pad too, and I have not used it in a morning time yet, but part of my idea for it too was like, that takes away the extra minutes. Like if I get up, you know, brush my teeth, either eat my breakfast before or right afterwards, who knows, but you know, do 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes. And then I'm already in my apartment. I can pop in the shower if I need to, I can just get ready and I can go. And it does take out those extra steps, those extra minutes of like, even a 7 minute drive to get to where you're trying to go. Like all of those minutes add up, and then I end up being late for work and then I'm more stressed. So, you know, doing something more contained, and you know, especially in these colder months, I still get to stay warm and cozy. I don't have to go outside yet. You know, and so that's kind of my plan for that too. And maybe there is a way to incorporate morning exercise, but in a different, you know, more subtle way. It would be less jarring for my system.
Yeah, and in a way that isn't you having to get up at 4:45 a.m. right? Like, and that's the difference. It's like, cool, I can actually achieve what I wanted to achieve, which is 30 minutes of walking, 30 minutes of movement, that I can literally get up at pretty much the same time, because I'm not having mm-hmm. to drive to the gym, do the class, drive home, shower, et cetera. So yeah, I think that's really realistic and a great way to do it. So yeah, big recommendation of anyone listening to this to do the similar thing, like not go, okay, I'm going to sign up to this thing, being really realistic and be like, how could I fit it into what I'm already doing? So yeah. Anything else that you've discovered this year that if you could talk to yourself in January last year, what would you say?
Well, I'm not sure this is exactly that, but there were a couple big changes that I noticed that were surprising that I wanted to, like, that I just did not foresee. For one, I've always had very high iron and ferritin, and kind of immediately after I think I was like 222 or something, which is very, very high, like August of last year, so pre any attempts to change anything. And then I got it tested about 1 month into the protocol and it was down to like 135. And then I just got it tested in November and it was 97, which is in your okay range. And you know, that kind of stuff is, you know, and I lost a little weight, which I try not to think about even, because that's where things get a little triggering for me, surprisingly, you know. And so it's kind of exciting, but I want it to be a side effect of what I'm doing and never my goal. And again, focusing on my why and all of that stuff, and nothing in there is about losing weight and keeping it that way. But I, you know, I have lost a little bit of weight. And the other thing is my resting heart rate, Like, if I look at my, you know, I wear an Apple Watch every day, and I look at my trends, and I started this in June, and like, starting in June through now, my resting heart rate has consistently been the lowest that it's been ever. And I was like looking it up, and I talked to you guys about it too, and like the relationship between insulin resistance and resting heart rate, and like these weird things that are proof that I'm like making a difference in my insulin, which is really exciting, but like not something I ever would have like correlated myself. But like literally the chart immediately dips down and has like, you know, ranged a little bit, but the range that it even is in is significantly different than the last couple of years of wearing my Apple Watch. So stuff like that has just been really exciting to see, because it's also like really stuff that you can't control in your brain and like make, you know, but it's just kind of these fun little proofs that what I'm doing is affecting my body, and that I'm finally treating my body the way that it wanted to be treated. And, you know, that's been really, really fun for me.
Yeah. And it's just that knowing, okay, I'm working with my body now to help that, mm-hmm. rather than, I'm sure that you were, it's not that you weren't trying, right? I know that about you. That's something I know for sure, is that it's not that you weren't trying. It's just that what you were doing wasn't working because you didn't have the right information to understand.
Yeah, I didn't have the right information. And, you know, and as, again, as someone with a history of binge eating disorder, like, it's always been kind of an issue. Not always, but you know, with my mom and like with that kind of stuff, and just like if that's a very common theme in people with eating disorders, and you know, also the different generations and diet culture and everything. But my mom actually works in drug development, and her background's in chemistry, and she even specializes in like diabetics and like drugs for diabetes. And so all of this stuff and finally understanding the science of it has also been like an amazing like link for us. And she'll like send me these articles of like, oh, like the New York Times is now saying like these are the things of PCOS, like does this agree with what you're seeing? Like we can talk about it in these scientific ways and like these facts ways, and in a way that, you know, we hadn't been able to talk about kind of some of that stuff previously, because it's emotional and we come from different places. And you know, she never had a history of binge eating disorder, so she couldn't like see where I was coming from. But now that we have this, like, no, it's science. We can talk about science and kind of the similarities. And I'm also teaching her things, like, she, you know, insulin resistance being pre-diabetes, like there's overlap, but there are also some of the stuff I've told her from the podcast or from my own research and stuff has like surprised her. So it's gotten to be that like really nice link for us this year. And you know, we've always been really close, but it's been really exciting. And she knows a lot, but I also get to teach her some things and, you know, and stuff like that. So it's, I am so grateful for this podcast and this program. And I have a couple friends with PCOS, and like, I've been, you know, sending anyone who needs it the podcast and, you know, trying to share the knowledge, because it's changed my life.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think that what you're saying about your mom is so common, you know, often, and as being a mom myself, I know that, you know, you want to do the best for your child, and but sometimes that can come across in really the wrong way, you know, and mm-hmm. especially as you said, if she's not had that same experience as you of like the same kind of binge eating disorder and things, then she might approach things in a way that's really triggering for you. But, you know, like she's wanting to help maybe, but it's just the totally the wrong way that has actually really triggered you in that. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, coming up to Christmas now, so many people will be experiencing that, of family members maybe saying things or asking them questions that they just find so triggering, or they don't, you know, they're worried about this. Have you found anything, any ways of talking about this with your mum? Obviously the science has been really helpful, but anything else that you've been able to a phrase or something that when she does say something that you find triggering or that you don't want to talk about, then you can easily kind of deflect that conversation?
I would say for like this specific relationship, like we've had a journey in my life, and we're really in a place now where that doesn't happen as much anymore, because I did set up some, you know, previous boundaries and stuff, and we're, you know, we were already in a good place by the time I was finding this protocol as well. I would say the thing that I do is I include her in ways, so rather than like shutting, you know, having the shutting things down conversation, which again, if people are saying certain things, like that is sometimes what you have to do. But you know, when I went home for Thanksgiving, I'm going home again for, you know, the winter holidays, and I it's part of the, you know, we plan the meal, the menu together, and like, you know, and I made her your salmon recipe, and you know, I use the, I've made it a bunch now actually for my whole family, and like I'll make it with coconut aminos, but I'm always like, if you want to make it with soy sauce when I'm not here, feel free, you know, and that kind of thing. But so kind of, and she'll be like, is this, she wants that, like, and it, like you said, it all comes from a place of love and a place of wanting to help, but sometimes there's just like a misunderstanding there. And like, I know that when I have a kid, like, you know, I'm going to handle this a certain way, but there's going to be something that they have that I never dealt with that I'm going to mess up. And like, that's just how it goes. But she, you know, she wants to get be included and she wants to help me. And so it's kind of like, yeah, actually, like if we do this meal, I always want to make sure I have like a leafy green, like, you know, yes, we can do your corn and we can do potatoes, but I also need broccoli. And like, just having these conversations and then letting her feel, you know, included in that process with me, and then also helping cook and, you know, doing that kind of stuff just to ensure that things are going to be good for me. Cause she wants, you know, she wants things to be good for me. And also like, you can still eat so much and like so many really good things. And sometimes you just have to like tweak one thing or tweak nothing, because it's already a great meal, but just prioritizing the things that would be, you know, good for me while I'm home, or like, we'll go for walks together, and, you know, just the stuff that I would want to do anyways, and like including her in the process in a way that's like bonding for us, rather than like, oh, well, I can't eat that, or like, oh, I don't want that, or oh, actually that meal's not going to be good for me, you know. And also like, if she wants to make a dessert, she can make her dessert. And, you know, like you've said before, maybe I'll have some the first night if I want, maybe I don't even want it, or sometimes I'll encourage her to make desserts that I know I don't like. just an easier kind of move. But yeah, I would say that's my personal, what we've kind of been doing on that front. Again, if people are saying certain things, or, you know, you've tried to set boundaries and they can't be set, things obviously need to be handled differently. But sometimes people just want to feel like they're helping you and they're a part of the process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's such a great way of looking at it, because often it is the first thing we think of is to jump to, oh, well, you know. And I've even had people that are like, I'm not going home for Christmas this year because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to, or it's not going to help me, or they just kind of sit around and, you know, they're not active. And it's like, well, but what about if you were the instigator of this in your family, right? If you were the one that just quietly came along and was like, cool, this, you know, like, you guys make whatever you want for Christmas, and I'm going to bring this salad, I'm going to bring this sprout, like Brussels with, you know, stir fried Brussels, and add that green, you know, that I then love, and also you might love too, and introduce you to something different. And I'm going to start a tradition that we go for a walk after Christmas. You know, we will put our, whatever, wherever we live, we put our snowshoes on, we put our jackets on, whatever it is, and we go and do this. And that actually can turn it into something really beautiful, rather than being the source of tension and aggression.
And when I was like, hey, can I cook a meal for everybody? I mean, she was over the moon. Yeah, she was like, I don't have to do anything. Also, like, you know, in college, I was not the best cook, and I was not the best at just, you know, surviving by myself. And so it was kind of this joke that she would, you know, quote unquote, failed as a mother, because I couldn't cook things very well. And so now being able, not only can I cook, I'm gonna make your dinner, and you can sit down, and, you know, and it's this meal that they now all really love, you know, that I've made a couple times on different trips home. And it's something that's really, really good for me, and they really enjoy. And it's kind of the best of both worlds. And also showing her that I can successfully take care of myself is always a positive.
And for all the Ovies listening, what's the salmon recipe that they can find?
It's the ginger soy salmon of yours. I make it so often, and I'm also thinking I'm gonna just try, like, maybe on some chicken thighs, and like do the same, because like that marinade is so good. It's a constant in my cycle, and we're a big salmon family anyways, but it's kind of a new thing in their rotation now, and it's easy to make for a little group. So, and I've made it on dates, like, you know, be like, oh, let's have dinner at my place, I'll cook you dinner, and like, you know, just all those ways to, you know, again, make things a little easier for me while including other people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what I always say to people as well, about if you're catching up with friends, be the one to instigate it, and therefore also choose the restaurant that you then know is going to be, it's going to work for you, right? Like, there's just ways around it, instead of going, oh no, I can't eat that and I can't eat that. Then yeah, you're just going to probably push people away, or, you know, it's going to be much harder. Whereas if you're like, okay, well, this is what I can do about it, I can be the one to instigate, I can be the one to choose, and it just makes things so much easier for yourself. So I think that's a very good way of going about it. So anything else you'd like to share? I mean, I think this has been an incredible, I have taken so much myself from it. I mean, I'm just writing down, I loved the journaling and starting with the lower barrier to entry, you are statements, and then moving into the I am statements. I'm definitely going to take that. I love the cozy cardio. I think that's, I mean, I, you know, there are certain like trends that are trends for a reason, but I think this is just a good one. I think it's just the fitting in with your life rather than forcing something that's, and I also, I mean, we didn't even really get into talking about your high iron, but I'll post a link to another podcast about that. I mean, a lot of people will be a bit confused about that and saying, I've never heard people talking about high iron before. Yes, it's quite uncommon for other people outside of PCOS to talk about it, but I probably see it in about 20 to 30% of our patients, actually too much iron, and that's actually making insulin resistance worse. So it's actually really good to see that as your insulin improves, your iron stores come down into a more normal level. So it's really good to see that. Some other people also have to donate blood to get that to happen as well. But for you, it's incredible to see that that's happened all on its own.
And as yeah, and pretty immediately like that. Yeah. Again, it was as soon as I started just, you know, making the first month's worth of changes. Like you do an amazing job of, you know, drip feeding or whatever the information, so it's not overwhelming. But you also start with, you know, the most important bits. And so even those small changes at the beginning were enough to like essentially shock my body in a way that I didn't feel shocked at all, but shock my body into, you know, these better processes that really have been working for my levels. So, and it's also, it's, I'm a numbers girl. So it's nice to have numbers to focus on that aren't weight and different and trends to focus on that aren't, again, like weight loss, because that's where things have gotten triggering for me in the past. So to see these like very real stats that show that I'm treating my body the way that it wants to be treated. And if weight happens to come up off with that, that's wonderful, but not making that something that I'm focusing on, rather focusing on these other, like, again, very tangible, very real things that are changing. So that's cool.
Yeah. And as you said, it can be, you know, these are just sort of tweaks to what you're already doing. They're not massive overhauls. And so a lot of people can find that a bit confronting because they're used to very, very severe changes. You know, you do these boot camp style things where you completely change what you're eating. You follow a meal plan, eat things that you've never eaten before, and you have to conform to a certain amount of exercise or something every day. And so you're used to that. And so it's quite hard when things aren't so severe to trust that they are enough. Like that is enough to actually enable change in your body. And you've proven that through, wow, I made these things. And within a month, I literally saw this in my iron stores. I also saw it in my resting heart rate, both of which directly correlate with your longevity and health. And
both are very important.
Those are very, very important things. So I think that's a really great testament to your the way that you've approached this and really followed along and just focusing on those small changes and incorporating them into your life. So a massive well done for everything that you've achieved this year, and especially through quite trying circumstances, you know, like where you went through, yes, when you started, you were on strike, but then you had to get used to going back into the office and actually incorporating this. And so it's not that things have been easy by any stretch for you. This has been a really challenging year, and I think that you've made some incredible changes, and you should be so proud going into 2024 of everything you've achieved this year.
Well, thank you. I can't believe it's been less than a year since I found you and your podcast, because it feels like it's been longer than that. But I'm so grateful to you and your team and the podcast and the protocol. And, you know, again, I could not more highly recommend it. And I'm honestly honored to be here. When I got on my first like protocol Zoom with you, it felt like I was meeting a celebrity, because I listened to so many of your podcasts and you were this like mythical, like helping figure out there. So yeah, I'm, you know, would love nothing more than my story to, you know, encourage or help someone else in the way that, you know, so many other women on your podcast have been an inspiration to me. So thank you so much for having me.
And thanks, Amanda, from episode two. Amanda, I think that those are, and I can only imagine that in a few episodes time, people will be talking about you and your story. So thanks so much for sharing that.
That would be cool. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening in, and a special thanks for Mariah for sharing her story and being so open with us. As you've heard, she's been doing our program now for some time. So unlike most other New Year's health and fitness plans that you might have done before, we aim to not only help you improve your symptoms, but ensure that you can still be maintaining these changes this time next year or in 2028, even through big changes in your life like what Mariah had. So if you want this for you, then join us in the OVI app. Head to www.ovie.io, that's O-V-I-E.io, the link's in the show notes, and start the questionnaire on the website to find out what's driving your PCOS.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.